I was thinking of your four-wheel drive. That was something to chew over, but not now. What else is on your mind? Miller was eager to go on. The pharmacy next door, that's on my mind. What about that? I opened my mouth to say I didn't have the slightest idea what he was talking about and then shut it with a snap. The Bridgeton Pharmacy had been doing business when we drove in yesterday. Not the laundromat, but the drugstore had been wide open. The doors chocked with rubber doorstops to let in a little cool air. The power outage had killed their air conditioning, of course. The door to the pharmacy could be no more than 20 feet from the door of the Federal Market. So why?
Why haven't any of those people turned up over here? Miller asked for me. It's been 18 hours. Aren't they hungry? They're sure not over there eating Dristan and stay-free mini-pads.
There's food, I said. They're always selling food items on special. Sometimes it's animal crackers, sometimes it's those toaster pastries, all sorts of things, plus the candy rack. I just don't believe they'd stick with stuff like that when there's all kinds of stuff over here.
What are you getting at?
What I'm getting at is that I want to get out, but I don't want to be dinner for some refugee from a grade B horror picture. 4 or 5 of us could go next door and check out the situation in the drugstore as a sort of trial balloon.
That's everything?
No, there's one other thing.
What's that?
Her, Miller said simply, and jerked his thumb toward one of the middle aisles. That crazy cunt. That witch.
It was Mrs. Carmody he had jerked his thumb at. She was no longer alone. 2 women had joined her. From their bright clothes, I guessed they were probably tourists or summer people, ladies who had maybe left their families to just run into town and get a few things, and were now eaten up with worry over their husbands and kids, ladies eager to grasp at almost any straw, maybe even the black comfort of a Mrs. Carmody. Her pantsuit shone out with its same baleful resplendence. She was talking, gesturing, her face hard and grim. The 2 ladies in their bright clothes, but not as bright as Mrs. Carmody's pantsuit, no, and her gigantic satchel of a purse was still tucked firmly under one doughy arm, were listening, raptly.
She's another reason I want to get out, Drayton. By tonight she'll have 6 people sitting with her. If those pink bugs and the birds come back tonight, she'll have a whole congregation sitting with her by tomorrow morning. And then we can start worrying about who she'll tell them to sacrifice to make it all better. Maybe me, or you, or that guy Hatlin. Maybe your kid.
That's idiocy, I said.
But was it?
The cold chill crawling up my back said not necessarily.
Mrs. Carmody's mouth moved and moved. The eyes of the tourist ladies were fixed on her wrinkled lips. Was it idiocy? I thought of the dusty stuffed animals drinking at their looking glass stream. Mrs. Carmody had power. Even Steph, normally hard-headed and straight from the shoulder, invoked the old lady's name with unease.
That crazy cunt, Miller had called her. That witch.
The people in this market are going through a Section 8 experience for sure, Miller said. He gestured at the red-painted beams framing the show window segments, twisted and splintered and buckled out of shape. Their minds probably feel like those beams look. Mine sure as shit does. I spent half of last night thinking I must have flipped out of my gourd, that I was probably in a straitjacket in Danvers, raving my head off about bugs and dinosaur birds and tentacles, and that it would all go away just as soon as the nice orderly came along and shot a wad of Thorazine into my arm. His small face was strained and white. He looked at Mrs. Carmody and then back at me. I tell you, it might happen. As people get flakier, she's going to look better and better to some of them, and I don't want to be around if that happens.
Mrs. Carmody's lips moving and moving, her tongue dancing around her old lady's snaggle teeth. She did look like a witch. Put her in a pointy black hat and she would be perfect. What was she saying to her 2 captured birds in their bright summer plumage? Arrowhead Project? Black Spring? Abominations from the cellars of the earth? Human sacrifice? Bullshit. All the same.
So what do you say?
I'll go this far, I answered him. We'll try going over to the drug. You, me, Ollie, if he wants to go, 1 or 2 others. Then we'll talk it over again. Even that gave me the feeling of walking out over an impossible drop on a narrow beam. I wasn't going to help Billy by killing myself. On the other hand, I wasn't going to help him by just sitting on my ass either. 20 feet to the drugstore. That wasn't so bad. "When?" he asked. "Give me an hour." "Sure," he said. 9. The expedition to the pharmacy. I told Mrs. Terman, and I told Amanda, and then I told Billy. He seemed better this morning. He had eaten 2 donuts and a bowl of Special K for breakfast. Afterward, I raced him up and down 2 of the aisles and even got him giggling a little. Kids are so adaptable that they can scare the living shit right out of you. He was too pale. The flesh under his eyes was still puffed from the tears he had cried in the night, and his face had a horribly used look. In a way, it had become like an old man's face, as if too much emotional voltage had been running behind it for too long. But he was still alive, and still able to laugh, at least until he remembered where he was and what was happening. After the wind sprints, we sat down with Amanda and Hattie Terman and drank Gatorade from paper cups, and I told him I was going over to the drugstore with a few other people. "I don't want you to," he said immediately, his face clouding. "It'll be all right, Big Bill. I'll bring you a Spider-Man comic book. I want you to stay here." Now his face was not just cloudy, it was thundery. I took his hand. He pulled it away. I took it again. "Billy, we have to get out of here sooner or later. You see that, don't you?" "When the fog goes away..." But he spoke with no conviction at all. He drank his Gatorade slowly and without relish. "Billy, it's been almost 1 whole day now."
"I want Mommy."
"Well, maybe this is the first step on the way to getting back to her." Mrs. Terman said, "Don't build the boy's hopes up, David." "What the hell?" I snapped at her. "The kid's got to hope for something." She dropped her eyes.
"Yes, I suppose he does."
Billy took no notice of this.
"Daddy, Daddy, there are things out there. Things."
"Yes, we know that. But a lot of them, not all, but a lot, don't seem to come out until it's nighttime."
"They'll wait," he said.
His eyes were huge, centered on mine.
"They'll wait in the fog, and when you can't get back inside, they'll come to eat you up, like in the fairy stories."
He hugged me with fierce, panicky tightness.
"Daddy, please don't go."
I pried his arms loose as gently as I could and told him that I had to. "But I'll be back, Billy."
"All right,"
he said huskily, but he wouldn't look at me anymore. He didn't believe I would be back. It was on his face, which was no longer thundery, but woeful and grieving. I wondered again if I could be doing the right thing, putting myself at risk. Then I happened to glance down the middle aisle and saw Mrs. Carmody there. She had gained a third listener, a man with a grizzled cheek and a mean and rolling bloodshot eye. His haggard brow and shaking hands almost screamed the word hangover. It was none other than your friend and his, Myron LaFleur. The fellow who had felt no compunction at all about sending a boy out to do a man's job. That crazy cunt. That witch. I kissed Billy and hugged him hard. Then I walked down to the front of the store, but not down the housewares aisle. I didn't want to fall under her eye. 3/4 of the way down, Amanda caught up with me.
"Do you really have to do this?" she asked.
"Yes, I think so."
"Forgive me if I say it sounds like so much macho bullshit to me."
There were spots of color high on her cheeks, and her eyes were greener than ever. She was royally pissed. I took her arm and recapped my discussion with Dan Miller. The riddle of the cars and the fact that no one from the pharmacy had joined us didn't move her much. The business about Mrs. Carmody did.
"He could be right," she said.
"Do you really believe that?"
"I don't know. There's a poisonous feel to that woman. And if people are frightened badly enough for long enough, They'll turn to anyone that promises a solution.
But human sacrifice, Amanda?
The Aztecs were into it, she said evenly. Listen, David, you come back. If anything happens, anything, you come back. Cut and run if you have to. Not for me. What happened last night was nice, but that was last night. Come back for your boy.
Yes, I will.
I wonder, she said, and now she looked like Billy, haggard and old. It occurred to me that most of us looked that way, but not Mrs. Carmody. Mrs. Carmody looked younger somehow, and more vital, as if she had come into her own, as if she were thriving on it.
We didn't get going until 9:30 a.m. Seven of us went. Ollie, Dan Miller, Mike Hatlin, Myron LaFleur's erstwhile buddy Jim, also hungover but seemingly determined to find some way to atone, Buddy Eagleton, myself. The seventh was Hilda Repler. Miller and Hatlin tried half-heartedly to talk her out of coming. She would have none of it. I didn't even try. I suspected she might be more competent than any of us, except maybe for Ollie. She was carrying a small canvas shopping basket, and it was loaded with an arsenal of Raid and Black Flag spray cans, all of them uncapped and ready for action. In her free hand she held a Spalding Jimmy Connors tennis racket from a display of sporting goods in aisle two.
"What's you gonna do with that, Mrs. Repler?" Jim asked.
"I don't know," she said. She had a low, raspy, competent voice. "But it feels right in my hand." She looked him over closely, and her eye was cold. "Jim Grandin, isn't it? Didn't I have you in school?" Jim's lips stretched in an uneasy, egg-sucked grin. "Yes'm, me and my sister, Pauline."
"Too much to drink last night?"
Jim, who towered over her and probably outweighed her by 100 pounds, blushed to the roots of his American Legion crew cut.
No.
She turned away curtly, cutting him off. "I think we're ready," she said. All of us had something, although you would have called it an odd assortment of weapons. Holly had Amanda's gun. Buddy Eagleton had a steel pinch bar from out back somewhere. I had a broom handle.
"Okay," Dan Miller said, raising his voice a bit. "You folks want to listen up a minute?"
A dozen people had drifted down toward the outdoor to see what was going on. They were loosely knotted, and to their right stood Mrs. Carmody and her new friends.
"We're going over to the drugstore to see what the situation is there. Hopefully we'll be able to bring something back to aid Mrs. Clapham."
She was the lady who had been trampled yesterday when the bugs came. One of her legs had been broken, and she was in a great deal of pain. Miller looked us over.
"We're not going to take any chances," he said. "At the first sign of anything threatening, we're going to pop back into the market."
"And bring all the fiends of hell down on our heads," Mrs. Carmody cried.
"She's right,"
one of the summer ladies seconded.
"You'll make them notice us. You'll make them come. Why can't you just leave well enough alone?"
There was a murmur of agreement from some of the people who had gathered to watch us go. I said, "Lady, is this what you call well enough?" She dropped her eyes, confused. Mrs. Carmody marched a step forward. Her eyes were blazing.
"You'll die out there, David Drayton. Do you want to make your son an orphan?"
She raised her eyes and raked all of us with them. Buddy Eagleton dropped his eyes and simultaneously raised the pinch bar as if to ward her off.
"All of you will die out there. Haven't you realized that the end of the world has come? The fiend has been let loose. Star Wormwood blazes, and each one of you that steps out that door will be torn apart. And they'll come for those of us who are left, just as this good woman said. Are you people going to let that happen?"
She was appealing to the onlookers now, and a little mutter ran through them.
"After what happened to the unbelievers yesterday, it's death. It's death! It's..."
A can of peas flew across two of the checkout lanes suddenly and struck Mrs. Carmody on the right breast. She staggered backward with a startled squawk. Amanda stood forward. "Shut up," she said. "Shut up, you miserable buzzard."
"She serves the foul one,"
Mrs. Carmody screamed.
A jittery smile hung on her face. Who did you sleep with last night, missus? Who did you lie down with last night? Mother Carmody sees. Oh, yes, Mother Carmody sees what others miss.
But the moment spell she had created was broken, and Amanda's eyes never wavered. Are we going, or are we going to stand here all day? Mrs. Repler asked. And we went. God help us, we went. Dan Miller was in the lead. Ollie came second. I was last, with Mrs. Repler in front of me. I was as scared as I've ever been, I think, and the hand wrapped around my broom handle was sweaty slick. There was a thin, acrid, and unnatural smell of the mist. By the time I got out the door, Miller and Ollie had already faded into it, and Hatland, who was third, was nearly out of sight. Only 20 feet, I kept telling myself. Only 20 feet. Mrs. Repler walked slowly and firmly ahead of me, her tennis racket swinging lightly from her right hand. To our left was a red cinder block wall. To our right, the first rank of cars looming out of the mist like ghost ships. Another trash barrel materialized out of the whiteness, and beyond that was a bench where people sometimes sat to wait their turn at the payphone. Only 20 feet. Miller's probably there by now. 20 feet is only 10 or 12 paces, so...
Oh, my God! Miller screamed. Oh, dear sweet God, look at this!
Miller had gotten there, all right. Buddy Eagleton was ahead of Mrs. Repler, and he turned to run, his eyes wide and starry. She batted him lightly in the chest with her tennis racket. Where do you think you're going? She asked in her tough, slightly raspy voice, and that was all the panic there was. The rest of us drew up to Miller. I took one glance back over my shoulder and saw that the Federal had been swallowed by the mist. The red cinderblock wall faded to a thin wash pink and then disappeared utterly, probably 5 feet on the Bridgeton Pharmacy side of the outdoor. I felt more isolated, more simply alone than ever in my life. It was as if I had lost the womb. The pharmacy had been the scene of a slaughter. Miller and I, of course, were very close to it, almost on top of it. All the things in the mist operated primarily by sense of smell. It stood to reason. Sight would have been almost completely useless to them. Hearing, a little better, but as I've said, the mist had a way of screwing up the acoustics, making things that were close sound distant, and sometimes things that were far away sound close. The things in the mist followed their truest sense. They followed their noses. Those of us in the market had been saved by the power outage as much as by anything else. The electric eye doors wouldn't operate. In a sense, the market had been sealed up when the mist came, but the pharmacy doors, they had been chocked open. The power failure had killed their air conditioning, and they had opened the doors to let in the breeze. Only something else had come in as well. A man in a maroon T-shirt lay face down in the doorway. Or at first I thought his T-shirt was maroon. Then I saw a few white patches at the bottom and understood that once it had been all white. The maroon was dried blood, and there was something else wrong with him. I puzzled it over in my mind. Even when Buddy Eagleton turned around and was noisily sick, it didn't come immediately. I guess when something that final happens to someone, your mind rejects it at first. Unless maybe you're in a war. His head was gone. That's what it was. His legs were splayed out inside the pharmacy doors, and his head should have been hanging over the low step, but his head just wasn't. Jim Grondin had had enough. He turned away, his hands over his mouth, his bloodshot eyes gazing madly into mine. Then he stumbled, staggered back toward the market. The others took no notice. Miller had stepped inside. Mike Hatland followed. Mrs. Repler stationed herself at one side of the double doors with her tennis racket. Ollie stood on the other side with Amanda's gun drawn and pointing at the pavement. He said quietly, "I seem to be running out of hope, David." Buddy Eagleton was leaning weakly against the payphone stall like someone who has just gotten bad news from home. His broad shoulders shook with the force of his sobs. "Don't count us out yet," I said to Ollie. I stepped up to the door. I didn't want to go inside, but I had promised my son a comic book. The Bridgeton Pharmacy was a crazy shambles. Paperbacks and magazines were everywhere. There was a Spider-Man comic and an Incredible Hulk almost at my feet, and without thinking, I picked them up and jammed them into my back pocket for Billy. Bottles and boxes lay in the aisles. A hand hung over one of the racks. Unreality washed over me. The wreckage, the carnage, that was bad enough. But the place also looked like it had been the scene of some crazy party. It was hung and festooned with what I at first took to be streamers. But they weren't broad and flat, they were more like very thick strings or very thin cables. It struck me that they were almost the same bright white as the mist itself, and a cold chill sketched its way up my back like frost. Not crepe. What? Magazines and books hung dangling in the air from some of them. Mike Hatman was prodding a strange black thing with one foot. It was long and bristly. "What the fuck is this?" he asked no one in particular. And suddenly, I knew. I knew what had killed all those unlucky enough to be in the pharmacy when the mist came. The people who had been unlucky enough to get smelled out. Out. "Out," I said. My throat was completely dry, and the word came out like a lint-covered bullet. "Get out of here!" Ollie looked at me.
"David?"
"They're spider webs," I said, and then two screams came out of the mist. The first of fear, maybe, the second of pain. It was Jim. If there were dues to be paid, he was paying them. "Get out!" I shouted at Mike and Dan Miller. Then something looped out of the mist. It was impossible to see it against that white background, but I could hear it. It sounded like a bullwhip that had been half-heartedly flicked. And I could see it when it twisted around the thigh of Buddy Eagleton's jeans. He screamed and grabbed for the first thing handy, which happened to be the telephone. The handset flew the length of its cord and then swung back and forth.
"Oh, Jesus, that hurts!"
Buddy screamed. Ollie grabbed for him, and I saw what was happening. At the same instant, I understood why the head of the man in the doorway was missing. The thin white cable that had twisted around Buddy's leg like a silk rope was sinking into his flesh. That leg of his jeans had been neatly cut off and was sliding down his leg. A neat circular incision in his flesh was brimming blood as the cable went deeper. Ollie pulled him hard. There was a thin snapping sound and Buddy was free. His lips had gone blue with shock. Mike and Dan were coming, but too slowly. Then Dan ran into several hanging threads and got stuck exactly like a bug on flypaper. He freed himself with a tremendous jerk, leaving a flap of his shirt hanging from the webbing. Suddenly, the air was full of those languorous bullwhip cracks, and the thin white cables were drifting down all around us. They were coated with the same corrosive substance. I dodged two of them more by luck than by skill. One landed at my feet and I could hear a faint hiss of bubbling hot top. Another floated out of the air and Mrs. Repler calmly swung her tennis racket at it. The thread stuck fast and I heard a high-pitched twing, twing, twing as the corrosive ate through the racket's strings and snapped them. It sounded like someone rapidly plucking the strings of a violin. A moment later, a thread wrapped around the upper handle of the racket and it was jerked into the mist. "Get back!" Ollie screamed. We got moving. Ollie had an arm around Buddy. Dan Miller and Mike Hatlin were on each side of Mrs. Repler. The white strands of web continued to drift out of the fog, impossible to see unless your eye could pick them out against the red cinder block background. One of them wrapped around Mike Hatlin's left arm. Another whipped around his neck in a series of quick winding up snaps. His jugular went in a jetting, jumping explosion, and he was dragged away, head lolling. One of his bass loafers fell off and lay there on its side. Buddy suddenly slumped forward, almost dragging Ollie to his knees.
"He's passed out, David. Help me."
I grabbed Buddy around the waist and we pulled him along in a clumsy, stumbling fashion. Even in unconsciousness, Buddy kept his grip on his steel pinch bar. The leg that the strand of web had wrapped around hung away from his body at a terrible angle.
Mrs. Repler had turned around.
"Where?" she screamed in her rusty voice. "Where behind you?"
As I started to turn, one of the web strands floated down on top of Dan Miller's head. His hands beat at it, tore at it. One of the spires had come out of the mist from behind us. It was the size of a big dog. It was black with yellow piping. Racing stripes, I thought crazily. Its eyes were reddish purple, like pomegranates. It strutted busily toward us on what might have been as many as 12 or 14 many-jointed legs. It was no ordinary earthly spider blown up to horror movie size. It was something totally different. Perhaps not really a spider at all. Seeing it, Mike Atlin would have understood what that bristly black thing he had been prodding at in the pharmacy really was. It closed in on us, spinning its webbing from an oval-shaped orifice on its upper belly. The strands floated out toward us in what was nearly a fan shape. Looking at this nightmare, so like the death-black spiders brooding over their dead flies and bugs in the shadows of our boathouse, I felt my mind trying to tear completely loose from its moorings. I believe now that it was only the thought of Billy that allowed me to keep any semblance of sanity. I was making some sound, laughing, crying, screaming, I don't know. But Ollie Weeks was like a rock. He raised Amanda's pistol as calmly as a man on a target range and emptied it in spaced shots into the creature at point-blank range. Whatever hell it came from, it wasn't invulnerable. A black ichor splattered from its body and it made a terrible mewling sound, so low it was more felt than heard, like a bass note from a synthesizer. Then it scuttered back into the mist and was gone. It might have been a phantasm from a horrible drug dream, except for the puddles of sticky black stuff it had left behind. There was a clang as Buddy finally dropped his steel pinch bar.
"He's dead," Ollie said. "Let him go, David. The fucking thing got his femoral artery. He's dead. Let's get the Christ out of here."
His face was once more running with sweat and his eyes bulged from his big round face. One of the web strands floated easily down on the back of his hand and Ollie swung his arm, snapping it. The strand left a bloody wheel. Mrs. Repler screamed, "Where?" again, and we turned toward her. Another of them had come out of the mist and had wrapped its legs around Dan Miller in a mad lover's embrace. He was striking at it with his fists. As I bent and picked up Buddy's pinch bar, the spider began to wrap Dan in its deadly thread, and his struggles became a grisly, jittering death dance. Mrs. Repler walked toward the spider with a can of Black Flag insect repellent held outstretched in one hand. The spider's legs reached for her. She depressed the button, and a cloud of the stuff jetted into one of its sparkling, jewel-like eyes. That low-pitched, mewling sound came again. The spider seemed to shudder all over, and then it began to lurch backward, hairy legs scratching at the pavement. It dragged Dan's body, bumping and rolling behind it. Mrs. Repler threw the can of bug spray at it. It bounced off the spider's body and clattered to the hot top. The spider struck the side of a small sports car hard enough to make it rock on its springs, and then it was gone. I got to Mrs. Repler, who was swaying on her feet and dead pale. I put an arm around her. "Thank you, young man," she said. "I feel a bit faint." "That's okay," I said hoarsely. "I would have saved him if I could." "I know that." Ollie joined us. We ran for the market doors, the threads falling all around us. One lit on Mrs. Repler's marketing basket and sank into the canvas side. She tussled grimly for what was hers, dragging back on the strap with both hands, but she lost it. It went bumping off into the mist, end over end. As we reached the end door, a smaller spider, no bigger than a cocker spaniel puppy, raced out of the fog along the side of the building. It was producing no webbing. Perhaps it wasn't mature enough to do so. As Ollie leaned one beefy shoulder against the door so Mrs. Repler could go through, I heaved the steel bar at the thing like a javelin and impaled it. It writhed madly, legs scratching at the air, and its red eyes seemed to find mine and mark me.
"David!"
Ollie was still holding the door. I ran in. He followed me. Pallid, frightened faces stared at us. 7 of us had gone out, 3 of us had come back. Ollie leaned against the heavy glass door, barrel chest heaving. He began to reload Amanda's gun. His white assistant manager's shirt was plastered to his body, and large gray sweat stains had crept out from under his arms. "What?" someone asked in a low, hoarse voice. "Spiders," Mrs. Repler answered grimly. "The dirty bastard snatched my market basket." Then Billy hurled his way into my arms, crying. I held on to him, tight. 10. The Spell of Mrs. Carmody. The second night in the market. The final confrontation. It was my turn to sleep, and for 4 hours I remember nothing at all. Amanda told me I talked a lot and screamed once or twice, but I remember no dreams. When I woke up, it was afternoon. I was terribly thirsty. Some of the milk had gone over, but some of it was still okay. I drank a quart. Amanda came over to where Billy, Mrs. Terman, and I were. The old man who had offered to make a try for the shotgun in the trunk of his car was with her. Cornell, I remembered. Ambrose Cornell. "How are you, son?" he asked. "All right." But I was still thirsty and my head ached. Most of all, I was scared. I slipped an arm around Billy and looked from Cornell to Amanda. "What's up?" Amanda said. "Mr. Cornell is worried about that Mrs. Carmody. So am I." "Billy, why don't you take a walk over here with me?" Hattie asked. "I don't want to," Billy said. "Go on, Big Bill," I told him, and he went, reluctantly. "Now what about Mrs. Carmody?" I asked.
"She's stirring things up," Cornell said. He looked at me with an old man's grimness. "I think we got to put a stop to it, just about any way we can."
Amanda said, "There are almost a dozen people with her now. It's like some crazy kind of a church service." I remember talking with a writer friend who lived in Otisfield and supported his wife and 2 kids by raising chickens and turning out 1 paperback original a year, spy stories. We had gotten talking about the bulge in popularity of books concerning themselves with the supernatural. Galt pointed out that in the 40s, weird tales had only been able to pay a pittance, and that in the 50s, it went broke. "When the machines fail," he had said, while his wife candled eggs and roosters crowed querulously outside, "when the technologies fail, when the conventional religious systems fail, people have got to have something. Even a zombie lurching through the night can seem pretty cheerful compared to the existential comedy horror of the ozone layer dissolving under the combined assault of 1 million fluorocarbon spray cans of deodorant." We had been trapped here for 26 hours, and we hadn't been able to do diddly shit. Our 1 expedition outside had resulted in 57% losses. It wasn't so surprising that Mrs. Carmody had turned into a growth stock, maybe. "Has she really got a dozen people?" I asked.
"Well, only 8, Cornell said. "But she never shuts up. It's like those 10-hour speeches Castro used to make. It's a goddamn filibuster."
8 people. Not that many. Not even enough to fill up a jury box. But I understood the worry on their faces. It was enough to make them the single largest political force in the market, especially now that Dan and Mike were gone. The thought that the biggest single group in our closed system was listening to her rant on about the pits of hell and the 7 vials being opened made me feel pretty damn claustrophobic. "She started talking about human sacrifice again," Amanda said. "Bud Brown came over and told her to stop talking that drivel in his store. And 2 of the men that are with her, one of them was that man Myron LaFleur, told him he was the one who better shut up because it was still a free country. He wouldn't shut up, and there was a shoving match, I guess you'd say."
"Brown got a bloody nose," Cornell said. "They mean business."
I said, "Surely not to the point of actually killing someone." Cornell said softly,
"I don't know how far they'll go if that mess doesn't let up, but I don't want to find out. I intend to get out of here."
Easier said than done. but something had begun to tick over in my mind. Scent. That was the key. We had been left pretty much alone in the market. The bugs might have been attracted to the light as more ordinary bugs were. The birds had simply followed their food supply. But the bigger things had left us alone unless we unbuttoned for some reason. The slaughter in the Bridgeton pharmacy had occurred because the doors had been left chocked open. I was sure of that. The thing or things that had gotten Norton and his party had sounded as big as a house, but it or they hadn't come near the market. And that meant that maybe... Suddenly I wanted to talk to Ollie Weeks. I needed to talk to him.
"I intend to get out or die trying," Cornell said. "I got no plans to spend the rest of the summer in here."
"There have been 4 suicides," Amanda said suddenly.
"What?"
The first thing to cross my mind in a semi-guilty flash was that the bodies of the soldiers had been discovered.
"Pills," Cornell said shortly. "Me and 2 or 3 other guys carried the bodies out back."
I had to stifle a shrill laugh. We had a regular morgue going back there.
"It's thinning out," Cornell said. "I want to get gone."
"You won't make it to your car, believe me."
"Not even to that first rank? That's closer than the drugstore."
I didn't answer him. Not then. About an hour later, I found Ollie holding up the beer cooler and drinking a bush. His face was impassive, but he also seemed to be watching Mrs. Carmody. She was tireless, apparently, and she was indeed discussing human sacrifice again, only now no one was telling her to shut up. Some of the people who had told her to shut up yesterday were either with her today or at least willing to listen, and the others were outnumbered.
"She could have them talked around to it by tomorrow morning," Ollie remarked. "Maybe not, but if she did, who do you think she'd single out for the honor?"
Bud Brown had crossed her. So had Amanda. There was the man who had struck her, and then, of course, there was me. "Ollie," I said, "I think maybe 6 of us could get out of here. I don't know how far we'd get, but I think we could at least get out."
"How?"
I laid it out for him. It was simple enough. If we dashed across to my scout and piled in, they would get no human scent, at least not with the windows rolled up.
"But suppose they're attracted to some other scent," Ollie asked. "Exhaust, for instance."
"Then we'd be cooked," I agreed.
"Motion," he said. "The motion of a car through fog might also draw them, David."
"I don't think so. Not without the scent of prey. I really believe that's the key to getting away."
"But you don't know."
"No, not for sure."
"Where would you want to go?"
"First, home, to get my wife."
"David?"
"All right, to check, to be sure."
"The things out there could be every place, David. They could get you the minute you stepped out of your scout into your dooryard."
"If that happened, the scout would be yours. All I'd ask would be that you take care of Billy as well as you could for as long as you could."
Ollie finished his bush and dropped the can back into the cooler where it clattered among the empties.
The butt of the gun Amanda's husband had given her protruded from his pocket. "South?" he asked, meeting my eyes.
"Yeah, I would," I said. "Go south and try to get out of the mist. Try like hell."
"How much gas you got?"
"Almost full."
"Have you thought that it might be impossible to get out?"
"I had. Suppose what they had been fooling with at the Arrowhead Project had pulled this entire region into another dimension as easily as you or I would turn a sock inside out."
"It had crossed my mind," I said, "but the alternative seems to be waiting around to see who Mrs. Carmody taps for the place of honor."
"Were you thinking about today?"
"No. It's afternoon already, and those things get active at night. I was thinking about tomorrow, very early."
"Who would you want to take?"
"Me, and you, and Billy. Hattie Terman. Amanda Dumfries. That old guy, Cornell, and Mrs. Repler. Maybe Bud Brown, too. That's 8, but Billy can sit on someone's lap and we can all squash together."
He thought it over.
"All right," he said finally.
We'll try. Have you mentioned this to anyone else?
No, not yet.
My advice would be not to, not until about 4 tomorrow morning. I'll put a couple of bags of groceries under the checkout nearest the door. If we're lucky, we can squeak out before anyone knows what's happening.
His eyes drifted to Mrs. Carmody again.
If she knew, she might try to stop us.
You think so? Ollie got another beer.
I think so, he said.
That afternoon, yesterday afternoon, passed in a kind of slow motion. Darkness crept in, turning the fog to that dull chrome color again. What world was left outside slowly dissolved to black by 8:30. The pink bugs returned, then the bird things, swooping into the windows and scooping them up. Something roared occasionally from the dark, and once, shortly before midnight, there was a long, drawn-out, that caused people to turn toward the blackness with frightened, searching faces. It was the sort of sound you'd imagine a bull alligator might make in a swamp. It went pretty much as Miller had predicted. By the small hours, Mrs. Carmody had gained another half a dozen souls. Mr. McVeigh the butcher was among them, standing with his arms folded, watching her. She was totally wound up. She seemed to need no sleep. Her sermon, a steady stream of horrors out of Dore, Bosch, and Jonathan Edwards, went on and on, building toward some climax. Her group began to murmur with her, to rock back and forth unconsciously, like true believers at a tent revival. Their eyes were shiny and blank. They were under her spell. Around 3 a.m., the sermon went on relentlessly, and the people who were not interested had retreated to the back to try to get some sleep. I saw Ollie put a bag of groceries on a shelf under the checkout nearest the outdoor. Half an hour later, he put another bag beside it. No one appeared to notice him but me. Billy, Amanda, and Mrs. Terman slept together by the denuded cold cut section. I joined them and fell into an uneasy doze. At 4:15 by my wristwatch, Ollie shook me awake. Cornell was with him, his eyes gleaming brightly from behind his spectacles. "It's time, David," Ollie said. A nervous cramp hit my belly and then passed. I shook Amanda awake. The question of what might happen with both Amanda and Stephanie in the car together passed into my mind and then passed right out again. Today it would be best to take things just as they came. Those remarkable green eyes opened and looked into mine. "David? We're going to take a stab at getting out of here. Do you want to come?" "What are you talking about?" I started to explain, then woke up Mrs. Terman so I would only have to go through it the once. "Your theory about scent," Amanda said. "It's really only an educated guess at this point, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"It doesn't matter to me," Hattie said. Her face was white, and in spite of the sleep she'd gotten, there were large, discolored patches under her eyes. "I would do anything, take any chances, just to see the sun again."
Just to see the sun again. A little shiver coursed through me. She had put her finger on a spot that was very close to the center of my own fears, on the sense of almost foregone doom that had gripped me since I had seen Norm dragged out through the loading door. You could only see the sun through the mist as a little silver coin. It was like being on Venus. It wasn't so much the monstrous creatures that lurked in the mist. My shot with the pinch bar had shown me they were no Lovecraftian horrors with immortal life, but only organic creatures with their own vulnerabilities. It was the mist itself that sapped the strength and robbed the will. Just to see the sun again. She was right. That alone would be worth going through a lot of hell. I smiled at Hattie, and she smiled tentatively back. "Yes," Amanda said. "Me too." I began to shake Billy awake as gently as I could. "I'm with you," Mrs. Repler said briefly. We were all together by the meat counter, all but Bud Brown. He had thanked us for the invitation and then declined it.
He would not leave his place in the market, he said, but added in a remarkably gentle tone of voice that he didn't blame Ollie for doing so. An unpleasant sweetish aroma was beginning to drift up from the white enamel case now, a smell that reminded me of the time our freezer went on the fritz while we were spending a week on the Cape. Perhaps, I thought, it was the smell of spoiling meat that had driven Mr. McVeigh over to Mrs. Carmody's team.
Expiation. It's expiation we want to think about now. We have been scourged with whips and scorpions. We have been punished for delving into secrets forbidden by God of old. We have seen the lips of the earth open. We have seen the obscenities of nightmare. The rock will not hide them. The dead tree gives no shelter. And how will it end? What will stop it?
Expiation, shouted good old Myron LaFleur.
Expiation. Expiation. They whispered it uncertainly.
Let me hear you say it like you mean it,
Mrs. Carmody shouted. The veins stood out on her neck in bulging cords. Her voice was cracking and hoarse now, but still full of power. And it occurred to me that it was the mist that had given her that power. The power to cloud men's minds, to make a particularly apt pun, just as it had taken away the sun's power from the rest of us. Before, she had been nothing but a mildly eccentric old woman with an antique store in a town that was lousy with antique stores. Nothing but an old woman with a few stuffed animals in the back room and a reputation for that witch, that cunt, folk medicine. It was said she could find water with an applewood stick, that she could charm warts and sell you a cream that would fade freckles to shadows of their former selves. I had even heard, was it from old Bill Giusti, that Mrs. Carmody could be seen, in total confidence, about your love life, that if you were having the bedroom miseries, she could give you a drink that would put the ram back in your rod.
Expiation!
They all cried together.
Expiation, that's right!
She shouted deliriously.
It's expiation! Gonna clear away this fog! Expiation! Gonna clear off these monsters and abominations! Expiation! Gonna drop the scales of mist from our eyes and let us see!
Her voice dropped a notch. And what does the Bible say expiation is? What is the only cleanser for sin in the eye and mind of God? Blood. This time the chill shuddered up through my entire body, cresting at the nape of my neck and making the hairs there stiffen. Mr. McVeigh had spoken that word. Mr. McVeigh, the butcher, who had been cutting meat in Bridgeton ever since I was a kid holding my father's talented hand. Mr. McVeigh, taking orders and cutting meat in his stained whites. Mr. McVeigh, whose acquaintanceship with the knife was long, yes, and with the saw and cleaver as well. Mr. McVeigh, who would understand better than anyone else that the cleanser of the soul flows from the wounds of the body. Blood, they whispered.
Daddy, I'm scared,
Billy said. He was clutching my hand tightly, his small face strained and pale. Ollie, I said, why don't we get out of this loony bin? Right on, he said. Let's go. We started down the second aisle in a loose group. Ollie, Amanda, Cornell, Mrs. Terman, Mrs. Repler, Billy, and I. It was 4:45 in the morning, and the mist was beginning to lighten again.
You and Cornell take the grocery bags, Ollie said to me.
Okay.
I'll go first. Your scout is a four-door, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. I'll open the driver's door and the back door on the same side. Mrs. Dumfries, can you carry Billy?
She picked him up in her arms. Am I too heavy? Billy asked. No, hon. Good.
You and Billy get in front, Ollie went on. Shove way over. Mrs. Terman in front, in the middle. David, you behind the wheel. The rest of us will—
Where did you think you were going?
It was Mrs. Carmody.
She stood at the head of the checkout line where Ollie had hidden the bags of groceries. Her pantsuit was a yellow scream in the gloom. Her hair frizzed out wildly in all directions, reminding me momentarily of Elsa Lanchester in The Bride of Frankenstein. Her eyes blazed. 10 or 15 people stood behind her, blocking the in and outdoors. They had the look of people who had been in car accidents, or who had seen a UFO land, or who had seen a tree pull its roots up and walk. Billy cringed against Amanda and buried his face against her neck. "Going out now, Mrs. Carmody," Ollie said. His voice was curiously gentle. "Stand away, please."
"You can't go out. That way is death. Don't you know that by now?"
"No one has interfered with you," I said. "All we want is the same privilege." She bent and found the bags of groceries unerringly. She must have known what we were planning all along. She pulled them out from the shelf where Ollie had placed them. One ripped open, spilling cans across the floor. She threw the other and it smashed open with the sound of breaking glass. Soda ran fizzing every which way and sprayed off the chrome facing of the next checkout lane.
"These are the sort of people who brought it on," she shouted. "People who will not bend to the will of the Almighty. Sinners in pride, haughty they are, and stiff-necked. It is from their number that the sacrifice must come. From their number, the blood of expiation."
A rising rumble of agreement spurred her on. She was in a frenzy now. Spittle flew from her lips as she screamed at the people crowding up behind her.
"It's the boy we want! Grab him! Take him! It's the boy we want!"
They surged forward, Myron LaFleur in the lead, his eyes blankly joyous. Mr. McVeigh was directly behind him, his face blank and stolid. Amanda faltered backward, holding Billy more tightly. His arms were wrapped around her neck. She looked at me, terrified. "David, what do I..."
"Get them both!"
Mrs. Carmody screamed.
"Get his whore, too!"
She was an apocalypse of yellow and dark joy. Her purse was still over her arm. She began to jump up and down.
"Get the boy, get the whore, get them both, get them all, get..."
A single sharp report rang out. Everything froze, as if we were a classroom full of unruly children and the teacher had just stepped back in and shut the door sharply. Myron LaFleur and Mr. McVeigh stopped where they were, about 10 paces away. Myron looked back uncertainly at the butcher. He didn't look back or even seem to realize that LaFleur was there. Mr. McVeigh had a look I had seen on too many other faces in the last 2 days. He had gone over. His mind had snapped. Myron backed up, staring at Ollie Weeks with widening, fearful eyes. His backing up became a run. He turned the corner of the aisle, skidded on a can, fell down, scrambled up again, and was gone. Ollie stood in the classic target shooter's position, Amanda's gun clasped in both hands. Mrs. Carmody still stood at the head of the checkout lane. Both of her liver-spotted hands were clasped over her stomach. Blood poured out between her fingers and splashed her yellow slacks. Her mouth opened and closed once, twice. She was trying to talk. At last she made it.
"You will all die out there," she said,
and then she pitched slowly forward. Her purse slithered off her arm, struck the floor, and spilled its contents. A paper-wrapped tube rolled across the distance between us and struck one of my shoes. Without thinking, I bent over and picked it up. It was a half-used package of Rolaids. I threw it down again. I didn't want to touch anything that belonged to her. The congregation was backing away, spreading out, their focus broken. None of them took their eyes from the fallen figure and the dark blood spreading out from beneath her body.
"You murdered her!"
someone cried out in fear and anger. But no one pointed out that she had been planning something similar for my son. Ollie was still frozen in his shooter's position, but now his mouth was trembling. I touched him gently.
Ollie, let's go. And thank you.
I killed her, he said hoarsely. Damn if I didn't kill her.
Yes, I said. That's why I thanked you. Now let's go. We began to move again. With no grocery bags to carry, thanks to Mrs. Carmody, I was able to take Billy. We paused for a moment at the door, and Ollie said in a low, strained voice,
I wouldn't have shot her, David. Not if there had been any other way.
Yeah.
You believe it?
Yeah, I do.
Then let's go.
We went out.
11. The End. Ollie moved fast, the pistol in his right hand. Before Billy and I were more than out the door, he was at my scout. An insubstantial Ollie, like a ghost in a television movie. He opened the driver's door, then the back door. Then something came out of the mist and cut him nearly in half. I never got a good look at it, and for that I think I'm grateful. It appeared to be red, the angry color of a cooked lobster. It had claws. It was making a low, grunting sound, not much different from the sound we had heard after Norton and his little band of flat earthers went out. Ollie got off one shot, and then the thing's claws scissored forward, and Ollie's body seemed to unhinge in a terrible glut of blood. Amanda's gun fell out of his hand, struck the pavement, and discharged. I caught a nightmare glimpse of huge, black, lusterless eyes, the size of giant handfuls of sea grapes, and then the thing lurched back into the mist with what remained of Ollie Weeks in its grip. A long, multi-segmented scorpion's body dragged harshly on the paving. There was an instant of choices. Maybe there always is, no matter how short. Half of me wanted to run back into the market with Billy hugged to my chest. The other half was racing for the scout, throwing Billy inside, lunging after him. Then Amanda screamed. It was a high, rising sound that seemed to spiral up and up until it was nearly ultrasonic. Billy cringed against me, digging his face against my chest. One of the spiders had Hattie Turman. It was big. It had knocked her down. Her dress had pulled up over her scrawny knees as it crouched over her, its bristly, spiny legs caressing her shoulders. It began to spin its web. Mrs. Carmody was right, I thought. We're going to die out here. We are really going to die out here.
Amanda!
I yelled. No response. She was totally gone. The spider straddled what remained of Billy's babysitter who had enjoyed jigsaw puzzles and those damned double cross-sticks that no normal person can do without going nuts. Its threads crisscrossed her body, the white strands already turning red as the acid coating sank into her. Cornell was backing slowly toward the market, his eyes as big as dinner plates behind his specs. Abruptly he turned and ran. He clawed the inn door open and ran inside. The split in my mind closed as Mrs. Repler stepped briskly forward and slapped Amanda, first forehand, then backhand. Amanda stopped screaming. I went to her, spun her around to face the scout, and screamed, "Go!" into her face. She went. Mrs. Repler brushed past me. She pushed Amanda into the scout's back seat, got in after her, and slammed the door shut. I yanked Billy loose and threw him in. As I climbed in myself, one of those spider threads drifted down and lit on my ankle. It burned the way a fishing line pulled rapidly through your closed fist will burn, and it was strong. I gave my foot a hard yank, and it broke. I slipped in behind the wheel.
"Shut it or shut the door, dear God!"
Amanda screamed. I shut the door. A bare instant later, one of the spiders thumped softly against it. I was only inches from its red, viciously stupid eyes. Its legs, each as thick as my wrist, slipped back and forth across the square bonnet. Amanda screamed ceaselessly like a fire bell. "Woman, shut your head," Mrs. Repler told her. The spider gave up. It could not smell us, ergo we were no longer there. It strutted back into the mist on its unsettling number of legs, became a phantasm, and then was gone. I looked out the window to make sure it was gone, and then opened the door.
What are you doing?
Amanda screamed, but I knew what I was doing. I like to think Ollie would have done exactly the same thing. I half-stepped, half-leaned out, and got the gun. Something came rapidly toward me, but I never saw it. I pulled back in and slammed the door shut. Amanda began to sob. Mrs. Repler put an arm around her and comforted her briskly. Billy said,
Are we going home, Daddy?
Big Bill, we're gonna try.
Okay,
he said quietly. I checked the gun and then put it into the glove compartment. Ollie had reloaded it after the expedition to the drugstore. The rest of the shells had disappeared with him, but that was all right. He had fired at Mrs. Carmody. He had fired once at the clawed thing, and the gun had discharged once when it hit the ground. There were four of us in the scout, but if push came right down to shove, I'd find some other way out for myself. I had a terrible moment when I couldn't find my key ring. I checked all my pockets, came up empty, and then checked them all again, forcing myself to go slowly and calmly. They were in my jeans pocket. They had gotten down under the coins, as keys sometimes will. The scout started easily. At the confident roar of the engine, Amanda burst into fresh tears. I sat there, letting it idle, waiting to see what was going to be drawn by the sound of the engine or the smell of the exhaust. 5 minutes, the longest 5 of my life, drifted by. Nothing happened.
Are we going to sit here or are we going to go? Mrs. Repler asked at last.
Go, I said. I backed out of the slot and put on the low beams. Some urge, probably a base one, made me cruise past the Federal Market as close as I could get. The scout's right bumper bunted the trash barrel to one side. It was impossible to see in except through the loopholes. All those fertilizer and lawn food bags made the place look as if it were in the throes of some mad garden sale. But at each loophole, there were 2 or 3 pale faces staring out at us. Then I swung to the left, and the mist closed impenetrably behind us. And what has become of those people, I do not know. I drove back down Kansas Road at 5 miles an hour, feeling my way. Even with the scout's headlights and running lights on, it was impossible to see more than 7 or 10 feet ahead. The earth had been through some terrible contortion. Miller had been right about that. In places the road was merely cracked, but in others the ground itself seemed to have caved in, tilting up great slabs of paving. I was able to get over with the help of the 4-wheel drive, thank God for that, but I was terribly afraid that we would soon come to an obstacle that even the 4-wheel drive couldn't get us over. It took me 40 minutes to make a drive that usually only took 7 or 8. At last, the sign that marked our private road loomed out of the mist. Billy, roused at 4:15, had fallen solidly asleep inside this car that he knew so well it must have seemed like home to him. Amanda looked at the road nervously.
Are you really going down there?
I'm going to try, I said. But it was impossible. The storm that had whipped through had loosened a lot of trees, and that weird twisting drop had finished the job of tumbling them. I was able to crunch over the first 2. They were fairly small. Then I came to a hoary old pine lying across the road like an outlaw's barricade. It was still almost 1/4 mile to the house. Billy slept on beside me, and I put the scout in park, put my hands over my eyes, and tried to think what to do next. Now, as I sit in the Howard Johnson's near exit 3 of the main turnpike, writing all of this down on Hojo's stationery, I suspect that Mrs. Repler, that tough and capable old broad, could have laid out the essential futility of the situation in a few quick strokes, but she had the kindness to let me think it through for myself. I couldn't get out. I couldn't leave them. I couldn't even kid myself that all the horror movie monsters were back at the Federal. When I cracked the window, I could hear them in the woods, crashing and blundering around on the steep fall of land they call the ledges around these parts. The moisture drip, drip, dripped from the overhanging leaves. Overhead, the mist darkened momentarily
as some nightmarish and half-seen living kite overflew us. I tried to tell myself, then and now, that if she was very quick, if she buttoned up the house with herself inside, that she had enough food for 10 days to 2 weeks. It only works a little bit. What keeps getting in the way is my last memory of her, wearing her floppy sun hat and gardening gloves on her way to our little vegetable patch with the mist rolling inexorably across the lake behind her. It is Billy I have to think about now. Billy, I tell myself. Big Bill. Big Bill. I should write it maybe 100 times on this sheet of paper like a child condemned to write, "I will not throw spitballs in school," as the sunny 3 o'clock stillness spills through the windows and the teacher corrects homework papers at her desk and the only sound is her pen, while somewhere, far away, kids pick up teams for scratch baseball. Anyway, at last I did the only thing I could do. I reversed the scout carefully back to Kansas Road. Then I cried. Amanda touched my shoulder timidly. "David, I'm so sorry," she said. "Yeah," I said, trying to stop the tears and not having much luck. "Yeah, so am I." I drove to Route 302 and turned left toward Portland. This road was also cracked and blasted in places, but was, on the whole, more passable than Kansas Road had been. I was worried about the bridges. The face of Maine is cut with running water, and there are bridges everywhere, big and small. But the Naples Causeway was intact, and from there it was plain, if slow, sailing all the way to Portland. The mist held thick. Once I had to stop, thinking the trees were lying across the road. Then the trees began to move and undulate, and I understood they were more tentacles. I stopped, and after a while they drew back. Once a great green thing, with an iridescent green body and long transparent wings, landed on the hood. It looked like a grossly misshapen dragonfly. It hovered there for a moment, then took wing again and was gone. Billy woke up about 2 hours after we had left Kansas Road behind and asked if we had gotten Mommy yet. I told him I hadn't been able to get down our road because of the fallen trees. "Is she all right, Dad?" "Billy, I don't know, but we'll come back and see." He didn't cry. He dozed off again instead. I would have rather had his tears. He was sleeping too damn much, and I didn't like it. I began to get a tension headache. It was driving through the fog at a steady 5 or 10 miles an hour that did it. The tension of knowing that anything might come out of it, anything at all. A washout, a land spill, or Ghidra, the three-headed monster. I think I prayed. I prayed to God that Stephanie was alive and that he wouldn't take my adultery out on her. I prayed to God to let me get Billy to safety because he had been through so much. Most people had pulled to the side of the road when the mist came, and by noon we were in North Windham. I tried the river road, but about 4 miles down, a bridge spanning a small and noisy stream had fallen into the water. I had to reverse for nearly a mile before I found a spot wide enough to turn around. We went to Portland by Route 302 after all. When we got there, I drove the cutoff to the turnpike. The neat line of toll booths guarding the access had been turned into vacant-eyed skeletons of smashed pola glass. All of them were empty. In the sliding glass doorway of one was a torn jacket with Maine Turnpike Authority patches on the sleeves. It was drenched with tacky, drying blood. We had not seen a single living person since leaving the Federal. Mrs. Repler said, "David, try your radio." I slapped my forehead in frustration and anger at myself, wondering how I could have been stupid enough to forget the scout's AM/FM for so long. "Don't do that," Mrs. Repler said curtly. "You can't think of everything. If you try, you will go mad and be of no use at all." I got nothing but a shriek of static all the way across the AM band, and the FM yielded nothing but a smooth and ominous silence.
"Does that mean everything's off the air?"
Amanda asked. I knew what she was thinking, maybe. We were far enough south now so that we should have been picking up a selection of strong Boston stations, WRKO, WBZ, WMEX. But if Boston had gone...
It doesn't mean anything for sure, I said. That static on the AM band is pure interference. The mist is having a damping effect on radio signals, too.
Are you sure that's all it is?
Yes, I said, not sure at all. We went south. The mileposts rolled past, counting down from about 40. When we reached mile one, we would be at the New Hampshire border. Going on the turnpike was slower. A lot of the drivers hadn't wanted to give up, and there had been rear-end collisions in several places. Several times I had to use the median strip. At about 1:20, I was beginning to feel hungry. Billy clutched my arm.
Daddy, what's that? What's that?
A shadow loomed out of the mist, staining it dark. It was as tall as a cliff, and coming right at us, I jammed on the brakes. Amanda, who had been catnapping, was thrown forward. Something came. Again, that is all I can say for sure. It may have been the fact that the mist only allowed us to glimpse things briefly, but I think it just as likely that there are certain things that your brain simply disallows. There are things of such darkness and horror, just, I suppose, as there are things of such great beauty, that they will not fit through the puny human doors of perception. It was six-legged, I know that. Its skin was slaty gray that mottled to dark brown in places. Those brown patches reminded me absurdly of the liver spots on Mrs. Carmody's hands. Its skin was deeply wrinkled and grooved, and clinging to it were scores, hundreds of those pinkish bugs with the stalk eyes. I don't know how big it actually was, but it passed directly over us. One of its gray, wrinkled legs smashed down right beside my window, and Mrs. Repler said later she could not see the underside of its body, although she craned her neck up to look. She saw only two cyclopean legs going up and up into the mist like living towers until they were lost to sight. For the moment it was over the scout, I had an impression of something so big that it might have made a blue whale look the size of a trout. In other words, something so big that it defied the imagination. Then it was gone, sending a seismological series of thuds back. It left tracks in the cement of the interstate, tracks so deep I could not see the bottoms. Each single track was nearly big enough to drop the scout into. For a moment no one spoke. There was no sound but our breathing and the diminishing thud of that great thing's passage. Then Billy said, "Was it a dinosaur, Dad? Like the bird that got into the market?" "I don't think so. I don't think there was ever an animal that big, Billy, at least not on Earth." I thought of the Arrowhead Project and wondered again what crazy damned thing they could have been doing up there.
"Can we go on?" Amanda asked timidly. "It might come back."
Yes, and there might be more up ahead, but there was no point in saying so. We had to go somewhere. I drove on, weaving in and out between those terrible tracks until they veered off the road. That is what happened. Or nearly all. There's one final thing I'll get to in a moment. But you mustn't expect some neat conclusion. There is no, and they escaped from the mist into the good sunshine of a new day. Or, when we awoke, the National Guard had finally arrived. Or even that great old standby, it was all a dream. It is, I suppose, what my father always frowningly called an Alfred Hitchcock ending, by which he meant a conclusion in ambiguity that allowed the reader or viewer to make up his own mind about how things ended. My father had nothing but contempt for such stories, saying they were cheap shots. We got to this Howard Johnson's near exit 3 as dusk began to close in, making driving a suicidal risk.
Before that, we took a chance on the bridge that spans the Saco River. It looked badly twisted out of shape, but in the mist it was impossible to tell if it was whole or not. That particular game, we won. But there's tomorrow to think of, isn't there? As I write this, it is 1:45 in the morning, July the 23rd. The storm that seemed to signal the beginning of it all was only 4 days ago. Billy is sleeping in the lobby on a mattress that I dragged out for him. Amanda and Mrs. Repler are close by. I'm writing by the light of a big Delco flashlight, and outside the pink bugs are ticking and thumping off the glass. Every now and then there is a louder thud as one of the birds takes one off. The scout has enough gas to take us maybe another 90 miles. The alternative is to try to gas up here. There is an Exxon out on the service island, and although the power is off, I believe I could siphon some up from the tank. But it means being outside. If we can get gas here or further along, we'll keep going. I have a destination in mind now, you see. It's that last thing I wanted to tell you about. I couldn't be sure. That is the thing, the damn thing. It might have been my imagination, nothing but wish fulfillment. And even if not, it is such a long chance. How many miles? How many bridges? How many things that would love to tear up my son and eat him even as he screamed in terror and agony? The chances are so good that it was nothing but a daydream that I haven't told the others. At least, not yet. In the manager's apartment, I found a large battery-operated multi-band radio. From the back of it, a flat antenna wire led out through the window. I turned it on, switched over to BAT, fiddled with the tuning dial, with the squelch knob, and still got nothing but static or dead silence. And then, at the far end of the AM band, just as I was reaching for the knob to turn it off, I thought I heard, or dreamed I heard, one single word. There was no more. I listened for an hour, but there was no more. If there was that one word, it came through some minute shift in the damping mist, an infinitesimal break that immediately closed again. One word. I've got to get some sleep. If I can sleep and not be haunted until daybreak by the faces of Ollie Weeks and Mrs. Carmody and Norm the Bag Boy, and by Steph's face, half-shadowed by the wide brim of her sun hat. There is a restaurant here, a typical Hojo restaurant with a dining room and a long, horseshoe-shaped lunch counter. I am going to leave these pages on the counter, and perhaps someday someone will find them and read them. One word. If I only really heard it. If only. I'm going to bed now, but first I'm going to kiss my son and whisper two words in his ear. Against the dreams that may come, you know? Two words that sound a bit alike. One of them is Hartford, the other is Hope.
The Mist was written by Stephen King and read by Will Patton. It was recorded by Julian Dreyer, editing and post-production by Mike Ticino for Common Mode. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producers were Tiffany Frari and Michael Noble. The Mist was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Mist is available in print from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Mr. Mercedes, Finders Keepers, and End of Watch, all written by Stephen King and read by Will Patton.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.